Okay, hello everyone. My name's Nick and I'm the head of theatre at The Pleasance, and welcome to Stamp Connects. For those who've joined us for any of the previous 3 days, but for the benefit of those who are joining us for the first time, Stamp is a network of over 50 organisations who work together to take practical collective action to improve the ways in which artists are supported by organisations and valued more widely in society. Session today is going to be BSL interpreted by Lynn and Rachel. And Lynn will be BSL interpreting first. So I'm just going to spotlight Lynn for anyone that's using the interpretation to be able to find Lynn. We will change interpreters about every 15 minutes and we'll slightly pause at that point so I can spotlight the new interpreter as they're changing over. So Stamp Connects Online is the biggest event we run every year. So it's normally held in person at Shoreditch Town Hall. This is the first time that we've hosted the event online. And thank you for joining our final panel discussion of what feels a little bit like a 3-day marathon. So thank you to everyone that's been to multiple sessions. And if it's your first time, welcome. The sessions today are also being captioned via Otter AI. So to activate the closed captions, please click the closed captions button at the bottom of your screen, or you can find it by clicking the three dots at the top of your screen if you're on a mobile. You can then click view closed captions. There'll also be a full transcript of the event by clicking on the top left-hand corner, and this should open a new window, which includes the transcript. Please, we're going to try and use the chat function to pose questions during the session. Chair will ask for these questions. If you ask your questions in the chat, or if you let me know if you'd like to directly address the panel with a question, and I'll have a bit of a running order so we can make sure we get through as many questions as possible in the shortest amount of time. If you have any trouble with tech or Zoom during the session, I'm here to help out, so just drop me a direct message in the chat and I'll be able to help you. That's it for me, so I'm going to hand over to Amy to begin the panel.
Hello everyone, thanks Nick. My name's Amy Claire Tasker. I'm a theatre maker and creative producer. I work with The Cockpit in Marylebone in London on their theatre maker artist development programme and the Voila Europe Theatre Festival. And I've been doing a bit of experimenting myself with digital tools for theatre and really, really looking forward to this conversation with some fellow artists and programmers who are really pioneering new forms in this crazy time, and even indeed before this crazy time. So I want to give us a little bit of a kind of conceptual introduction here before we hear from our panelists. So I'll talk for just a few minutes, then I'll ask them all to introduce themselves. Then we'll have a discussion kind of based on those ideas that come up in the introductions. And at the end, for the last 15 minutes or so, we will have a Q&A with all of you who have joined us today. And Nick is going to collect your questions so that we can address them at the end of the session. Brilliant. Thank you all so much for joining us. And thanks to our panelists and our interpreters for making this happen. All right. So I'll just dive into a little bit about what we are talking about when we're saying digital tools for theatre. There have been a number of really interesting formats that have emerged in the last year. For example, we've had live online interactive performances where audiences and performers are in the same digital space, like Zoom, Twitch, Gather, Wonder, and things like that. We've had live stream performances like National Theatre Live, that have actually, that's not what I mean. That's pre-recorded and streamed at a specific time. Live stream performances, what I mean when I say that is that the performance is happening at the same time that it's being streamed out online. We've seen on-demand performances. There's this new, you know, for example, Vault Festival or Vault TV that has got a pretty robust on-demand offer. We've seen multi-device experiences, so that might be live performances with the audience online in Zoom or watching on YouTube and on WhatsApp or Instagram on their phones. We've got stories that unfold via text message or email over several days that can be kind of durational, you know, 5-minute pre-recorded bits that or text bits that come to you over the course of a week or so. And we've also seen audio projects. that kind of pair with a specific physical experience, like, you know, a podcast or a story that you listen to while you're walking around your neighborhood. So those are lots of ways that digital performance can manifest. And I'm sure there are more, and I'm looking forward to hearing from our panelists if they think I've missed anything. But what I think is really interesting is that these technologies are not new, and artists have been using them in the before times, before we were all forced, if you like, online. What is new is that audiences and venues during the pandemic have been more willing to engage with these digital tools in the absence of in-person theatre. And I believe that when venues reopen, we won't return to how things were. I hope we won't, because we've discovered too much creative potential and too many benefits to go back, you know, to completely abandon all of these really interesting creative formats. Some of the great benefits that we've discovered are that artists can collaborate across borders, across time zones, even just across distances within the same region. Audiences can join in from anywhere in the world. I've been in performances with people from Russia and the US and South America all at the same time. And it's really, I think that's pretty groundbreaking to be able to create a shared cultural experience that goes beyond the physical here and now and people in the same area. And we've also seen that digital performances can increase access for people who find it difficult to get to a physical venue. So there's really good reasons to keep working with these digital tools as we open our venues again. I'm also really intrigued by what creative possibilities will emerge when we can have audiences in the venue and online in one show. How would you have two audiences in different spaces being part of the same experience? What would that look like? What would it look like if some of the performers were on stage and some of the performers were online? How would they interact with each other? So I'm really keen to see how theater makers explore this in the next few years. Right, that's my introduction. I'd now like to introduce each panelist, or rather invite them to introduce themselves and to share with us what they've been doing with digital theatre and what they've been thinking about, what's their kind of question or provocation related to our topic today. So I'll start with Kevin. Thanks, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for that. Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Jameson. I'm the head of program at Home in Manchester. We're a multi-art form venue that has two theatre spaces, five cinemas, and two galleries, amongst many other things. I'll try and be as concise as I can with what we've kind of been up to through the last 12 months. I think when lockdown first appeared, we initially thought we will bring out some archive recordings of previous work that we've done, and we'll put that out as kind of some content. I mean, obviously that was also a time when we thought, you know, the lockdown would be 3 weeks and everything would be all right kind of after that. And here we are 12 months later, but that was our initial reaction. And we started to look into that, but we also kind of figured that them recordings weren't really made for broadcast. So was that really fair to the artist to put out something that wasn't sort of broadcast a bull and not really meant for that? And that didn't really seem fair. So we quickly kind of changed our thinking around that, and also realizing and sensing the kind of impact for artists that the lockdown would have. So we came up with a strand of work that we called Homemakers, where we engaged a selection of artists who were obviously kind of at home to engage with audiences who were also at home. And they kind of, there were short commissions given to each artist, which kind of equated to roughly around 2 weeks work. So we knew it was going to kind of be a short, sharp kind of response piece to where they are, with the idea being that they were made within each artist's house, or, you know, with their collaborators virtually, and then to be put out in whatever way. We started with an initial cohort of about 8 to 10 in our initial batch, and we went to some of the artists that we've worked with before at home and who are Manchester based, but also kind of UK based. We did them, and that was a really great start, but we knew that kind of the budget for continuing that was going to be stunted, in terms of we didn't have a kind of unlimited budget for that. So what we then started to do was talk to other venues around the country to work with them as co-commissioning partners on it, to kind of come on board with the same terms, with the same kind of ethos that we were going into it with, to just expand that reach and expand the network of them. So, I mean, currently today we've done over 40 commissions as part of the Homemakers projects, and we've got another 12 that are about to go live kind of over the next 4 to 6 weeks, as we can continue through this. We'd initially kind of set it that I think we launched in the first one around April last year. We thought we'd just run till Christmas. We've since extended it, obviously, as the lockdowns have extended, and it seems sort of, a trite thing, but I've kind of just been constantly surprised by the creativity of the artists. Like, that's not to say that I thought the artists were not going to be creative through this process. I think it's how above and beyond they have gone with that. I think, you know, we have had lots of video and audio work through the project. But we've also kind of done a live 12-hour durational performance via Zoom. There's been instructions for a game, which you download and play kind of offline. We've done online games. We did a brilliant project called the Poetry Health Service, where you can log on, and depending on how you're feeling, through an algorithm, you get prescribed a poem to suit the mood of your day, and much more. And I just think how people were kind of really, and artists were exploring that was amazing. And it was also interesting for us, I think, in the terms of digital for us started to mean not live. Like, so it could be anything. So it's not necessarily that it's online, even though, you know, so that became kind of a weird change of the wording, I think, from our end, that digital was not live. So with the commissions as well, we've worked with UK artists and international artists. So we've had international collaborations through that. And ultimately, the ticketing was all done on Pay What You Decide. And, you know, a portion, half that box office return went to the artists, and half went to the venues that were supporting that as well. So it was a kind of way of also earning sort of more money for the artists at a time when they were struggling to earn anything. So that was our, you know, without sort of going too far into that, was our Homemakers project. The other thing that we did do as well, we did reopen the venue in October, and we're full of hope for that. And then obviously another lockdown descended. So we did then also quickly pivot to doing live streaming as well through that period of time. So all the planned live program that we had moved to a live stream, which also kind of enabled two of the companies, which one was Ship Theatre and one was David Hoyle, which had quite a bit of interactivity with it to really rethink how that would work. So David did a live eBay auction that was interactive as part of the show. And Ship Theatre, there was a WhatsApp group that kind of was there running alongside it. Part of that was key to the show, but also it started to generate almost like a kind of, you know, live chat along for audiences, you know, as well through that. So, so that's the kind of mix of work that we've been doing in Manchester, I guess, over the past 12 months without going too deeper into that. And I guess, you know, our kind of, you know, top, what's the word, provocation or whatever the term, sorry, I forgot the name, what the terminology was. I guess from our point of view that we're really wrestling with is, I guess it does now feel the genie's out of the bottle with digital, and that venues for so long have been kind of thinking around digital, but not really, you know, done too much with that. I think now it's really a proven thing. And I think, you know, what you were saying earlier, Amy, is right. It will not disappear once venues reopen. So I guess, you know, from our point of view, we're wrestling with how do venues really support artists through that, as in, you know, from both elements. So if people are wanting to, you know, just make digital work, the programming side of that, is it a hybrid approach? The development of that as well. We're also aware, you know, around things like digital poverty for audiences as well. So that, you know, and artists, you know, you need kit to make stuff, right? So, you know, all that sort of stuff. So we're already starting to think of, you know, artist development kind of opportunities where it's just money to buy kit, for example, or, you know, that sort of stuff, as well as kind of the usual stuff. So there's a lot in that, but that's kind of where we're at in terms of resting with that, I suppose.
Yeah. Super. Thanks so much for that, Kevin. Before we go to Paula, we'll swap BSL interpreters. So we'll just pause a moment while that happens. Looks like Rachel's ready. Super. Thanks. Paula, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Paula. I'm an artist working in video performance and participation. I've primarily been a solo maker, but increasingly over the last few years, I've been making more collaborative work. And I'm, through that, one half of a company called Varjek Lowry with my collaborator, Chuck Blue Lowry. And I think, as someone who's an interdisciplinary maker who sometimes feels like I've literally had lots of different lives through these art forms, I originally trained as a stage manager. I then went into training into filmmaking. I worked in the animation industry for many years where I looked up over audio production and sound design, then got into kind of underground cabaret performance and spoken word, and ended up as an interdisciplinary theater maker. So in a weird way, as difficult as the last year has been, it's kind of been very well suited to the experiences I've had before this period. Also as someone who is biracial, bisexual, and binational, and used to being in between and blurring of spaces. And I suppose what I've discovered more than anything is that I always had a digital practice, even though I didn't call it that. I was a blogger before I wrote monologues. I was doing remote collaborations with, even though this makes me feel ancient, with producers on MySpace in different parts of the world. I really miss that. Actually, I'm trying to find a way to bring that back. And then as soon as I started making theater work, I was always trying to figure out how to bring my film practice into it. And as I started doing shows, I was really interested in how to use social media to extend the work. So it would be about scratching the work effectively by sharing images on my social media while I was in rehearsal rooms. Or if I had interview material that was within the show, I would also have video series on Vimeo. And it was always with an understanding that it might be an additional offer for people who come and see the work in the theatrical space, but it might mean it reaches a completely different audience, and that's okay too. I think in the last year, however, when I haven't been able to make work in physical spaces, and I'm always very specific about saying physical spaces rather than live or digital, because I personally find those two words really unhelpful in how broad they are, has been the challenges that have been posed in doing my participation educational work, which more than anything is where I found the greatest innovation in the sector in the last year, because rather than just having shows canceled from one week to the next, I had to figure out how to deliver sessions on Zoom that I never had before to young participants I was working with, or I had to figure out how to teach devising to my students at Guildhall without ever having done that before. And it's being pushed through those changes that I think has put my work in an even more exciting place. And I guess where I'm at now is really thinking about creating work for devices. So thinking about devices in a kind of site-specific way, and also kind of challenging what this word hybrid means, which I also find bizarre as a new term when we've got years of people watching reality shows, for example, while voting on their phones and or tweeting along to programs. Like that. None of this is new. It's new to theater, but it's been happening within television and film and online for a while. And I'm interested in taking on all of that. But I guess in terms of where we're headed, I kind of have the same provocation and a positive and cynical spin. So the positive spin would be, having learned all these different ways to develop, or how some of us have, what does the future of hybrid look like now that we know what is possible? And then the cynical side of me, especially being in rooms of people who are not enthusiastic about any of this stuff, is how transformative has this period been really? Because I also feel like I've been in a lot of rooms of people who are like, that was great, we're done. We never want to deal with it ever again. We didn't see any online work. We hate Zoom. We don't know what other platforms are. And those people just want to see this all done. And as much as I am very enthusiastic and excited about the people in this space, like I think the work that Home has been programming has been really exciting. It was really great to see Rich Kids both in Frontiers at Sundance as well as having seen it at Edinburgh. I've worked with Tom in the past. I love how he's embracing the medium. I don't think Nick is that excited about Nigel, but I think he's trying with me. I think it's great. I don't know what the conversation is going to be in a year's time. I hope we can keep it going, but I guess we'll just see what happens.
Fantastic. Thanks, Paula. That's a really rich contribution there. Lovely. Javad, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, no, definitely. My name is Javad Alipour, and I am primarily artistic director of a small producing company called the Javad Alipour Company. Not necessarily the most imaginative title for a company that anyone's ever come across, but, you know, it does what it says on the tin. We work a lot with Home. You know, we're one of their associate companies. I'm based in Manchester. Over the past couple of years before the pandemic, I was making writing and sort of being in and co-directing some plays, shows, which were largely about the intersection of contemporary politics and contemporary theatre. One thing I should say is if I move around and wriggle around weirdly in my chair, forgive it, I've completely fucked my upper back and neck in lockdown. So, do you know what I mean? Just go with that. You know, the poor posture and the no gym and everything. In any case, you know, ignoring that, I was lucky in the sense that before lockdown, I was already playing around with exactly what Paula talked about in terms of, we were thinking about as double screening. So we were making work which was about the intersection of contemporary politics and contemporary technology and trying to complicate slightly. You know, I feel like there's two kinds of chat about contemporary tech. One, which is like a kind of a breathless utopianism, and the other, which is a kind of grim, anything that bad that happens in the world is because of Twitter. And we were trying to just complicate that chat a bit, you know. So we made a show called The Believers Are But Brothers, which was largely about masculinity, politics, the internet, violence, and these things. And we made a show called Rich Kids, the History of Shopping Malls in Tehran, that Paula mentioned. And so we were kind of lucky in the sense that we had this work which had like a digital component, like what people call double screening, the way you watch a show on TV and you talk about it on Twitter, whatever, as we went into lockdown. And so we had this stuff that we were able to like kind of spin into stuff that would happen online but still be live. And when we opened the digital version of Rich Kids, I think we were lucky again that like that was a few months into lockdown. So actually we'd had a little bit of everything going online. Do you know what I mean? And it was in the summer last year. And it just felt like what was really clear was there was a hunger for, you know, something happening at 7:30 and you know other people doing it at the same time rather than watch it on YouTube whenever you like. So we just embraced that, and that we were very lucky, and that show found its audiences, and it's going around the world at the minute. And I think I would say two things provocation wise, very quickly. One is that, you know, actually, and again, it's great to speak after as part of such a great panel and in a way be able to reiterate one of the things that Paula was saying, which is this question of saying like making work for devices and that kind of stuff. One really interesting thing to point out is that actually you don't have to be super techie to do that. Like, actually what we're doing when we're doing that is largely the same shtick as like the Living Theatre playing with microphones in 1963 or whatever. Do you know what I mean? There's something liberating about that you don't need to be able to code, you don't need to find like a tech bro to come and do the work for you, whatever. You can just play around with stuff. The other thing that I hope we do learn from this, and this, you know, one of the things we're working on at the minute is a podcast about anti-racist politics in the UK, The Colour of Our Politics, coming to all good places where you download podcasts on the 8th of April, so please do listen. And one of the reasons we're doing that work is because actually certain tech platforms are good at building certain kinds of audiences. And as a sector, more broadly, in terms of comms, in terms of marketing, we haven't started to do that work yet. We don't think about how stuff that sits at a slightly oblique angle to perhaps what we think of as the main part of our work, how we can actually like spin stuff off which is native to that space. And of course, the reason I give the example of a podcast is like literally the famous thing about podcasts is they're good for building communities because you get to talk into someone's ear once a week for an hour. Do you know what I mean? That's quite, what do you call it? You know, a very kind of close relationship to have with someone. So I think if I've got a provocation for people, which is broader than what art you make, it's that. How do we, the internet is really good for making community, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worst. How do we, you know what I mean, get a little touch of that, basically.
Wonderful. Thanks, Javad. Tom, can you go ahead?
Thanks, Amy. Hi, everyone. I'm Tom. I'm the artistic director of Upstarts Theatre, and we're a small-ish theatre company working out of London. And our mission is to do what we call reimagine the world by making theatre playable. So we're particularly interested in interactive and playable work. We want to make theatre for audiences who want to play, which means giving them genuine and meaningful agency in what's happening in performance. And we came to that after some years sort of starting off really very much as a new writing company and doing plays by, you know, emerging writers at the earliest stages in their careers. Evolved into devising work and then sort of really brought together my love of theatre-ness with my love of play and game. And part of that sits within the digital realm. So, you know, things like video games, and part of that sits within live stuff. So whether that's sport or board games or the kind of drama games that you might play in a rehearsal room or in a workshop or whatever. So we kind of, the pandemic hit us really as we were starting as a company to pivot towards this way of thinking where putting play and playfulness and game was at the heart of our work. So in some ways we were able to adapt quite well to everything that happened and to take more stuff into an online space than perhaps we would have done. I feel like I live for the liveness of theatre, really. I've really, like, that's what I feel really deprived of over the last year when it comes to theatre itself. But so my big provocation for everybody, and I'll talk briefly about some of the things that we've been doing with my company in the last year, but my big provocation is how do we take things into an online space or a digital space or whatever language we want to use to describe that space, a space that isn't the traditional live theatre environment, while retaining the sense of a shared event. Rachel Briscoe, who's one of the co-artistic directors of a company called Fast Familiar, really brilliant maker of playable theatre, talks about the quality of eventiness that even if we're not in the same physical space and even if we're not in the same time, we're still feeling like we're sharing part of the same experience. And that, if that's at the heart of what makes theatre theatre, how can we retain that while using all of the amazing tools that are available to us within the digital realm? So some of the things that we've done in the last year, well, we, for the last 5 years, we've been running a thing called Dare Festival, of which Paul has been a part before, which is a festival of new and emerging work. And it normally happens in The Ditch, which is the basement space at Shoreditch Town Hall in East London. And obviously that wasn't possible for this year's one. So we ran it as an online festival. And so we used Gather, an amazing, I would highly recommend, conferencing platform to create a front of house venue space and then presented five shows live over digital conferencing platforms, and one show which morphed over the time we were working with it into an installation that ran off a video game system called Unity. And we've also this year finished a big four national project with partner companies in Macedonia and Germany and Austria, all of which were supposed to be presenting live last month and ended up being presented online as mostly as timed streams. So, you know, it's 7:30. We're now streaming this thing over YouTube. We launched something into space and made a film of it and a video game of it. That was quite fun. And we made a podcast as well. So we've been taking some time this year to really experiment with, like, what are the different forms out there that we can use. So yeah, I think there is totally a thing that we can all be talking about as makers of theatre and performance about, like, how do these tools enable us to build on our existing practices? How do they let us expand? Sometimes that involves, as Javad was saying, sometimes that involves using tech that we're already using. Sometimes it does involve learning code. And I think that the big thing that I've learned this year is that learning code isn't that difficult. It involves taking some time, but it's not that tricky. If you can write a budget for a show, you can totally write code. It's easier, actually, to write code. Theatre is a 19th century medium, I think, and British theatre by and large, and I probably wouldn't include anyone in the Zoom call as this, but I would say by and large, British theatre is an incredibly 19th century medium, right? We have a mode of production that basically evolved in the 1880s, you know, and that's like Anton Chekhov writes a play, Stanislavski directs it, a bunch of people are in it, we rehearse, we perform it, rinse and repeat. And we have and one thing that the pandemic has forced all of us to do in the sector is think like people who live in the 21st century when we're at work, because we all do that all the time at home. You know, like I spend much more time watching Netflix than I have done watching digital theatre in the last year. And I'm sure that's true for many of the people who are here. Why? Because they're better at it than we are. And I think this is an opportunity for us to, as a sector, to really think about like how are the ways that we want to take our unique approaches to storytelling and creativity to create those shared experiences. Because one thing that you can't replicate through watching a show on Netflix is that sense that we're all in it together. But what they can do, because of their vast marketing budgets and all kinds of resources and the fact that they're in your house already, you can create a sense of event by when you drop a show on Netflix and people are responding to it. How can we create that same sense of shared event on the human scale of theatre? I think is my big thing that I want to be asking everybody.
Wonderful. Thanks, Tom. We're going to take a moment here to pause and swap interpreters and also let all of those wonderful provocations sink in. Are you ready, Lynn? Fantastic. Thank you. All right. So the next 20 minutes or so. Great. We're doing really well for time. Good job, everyone. The next 20 minutes or so, we'll pick up on some of those provocations, some of those ideas that came out in those introductions. And I'll ask the panel to respond to the things that each other have brought up. I love this because this is where my head is from Tom's contribution, this sense of event, the human scale of theatre, I think, is a really good phrase. I think there's sometimes I've heard people say, oh, well, why should I bother putting my show online? Because Netflix is better at it. And I think the human scale of it, the eventiness, and the live, potentially the interactivity of it. For me, interactivity is a really big part of what theater can do, online that Netflix can't. So I wonder if anyone else has thoughts about how you see your work as different than what Netflix is doing.
I'm happy to jump in on that one. I mean, I not to start off disagreeing with Tom, who's a really lovely person, but I personally don't think it's very helpful to think about how can we compete with Netflix. And I think I find when I have that conversation, it completely shuts down the conversation. I've actually spent this time watching a lot of digital theater, some that I haven't really liked, some of it just kind of a bit meh, but I found that really exciting. I probably watched less Netflix, especially in like lockdown number one and lockdown number two, because I was just trying to understand what was this new form emerging that might not be there later, and Netflix would still be there later somehow, and it was giving something different. And I think I've also sort of experimented with streaming my own events, both like streaming a kind of like archive material and also doing like a live events, like kind of events with like lots of different performers. And what I found about that is it's putting that energy into whatever that virtual foyer space or whatever the watch along space is that really does it. And that's something I completely nicked wholesale from watching Shit Theaters, Shit actually at Home, because that they had a WhatsApp watch along and it was so live. It was genuinely live and really interesting. And I thought, okay, I want to steal that. I'd also seen My White Best Friend, which, you know, had a kind of watch along model as well. And it had like special sessions afterwards to chat with people. I kind of took that. And what I found is that audiences, there was something I think that Javad touched on, which is like, after there was, you can watch this at any time. And there's, you can watch this at one time with people, you know, because you enter the WhatsApp or you enter the room, you're like, all right, I know Kevin, I know Javad, I know Tom. Now we can message each other while we're watching a thing. I think it doesn't serve all kinds of work. Like, I think it works really well when it's something like comedy or storytelling where you can come in and out, or, you know, I stream something that's like something a lot of people wanted to watch for a second time, they could talk during it. But I also found it really interesting that initially I thought, oh no, people are talking during an event. And then I realized, no, but this is a format where that's okay. In the theater, we can't talk out loud to each other, but I can choose to join this WhatsApp watch along or not. And I think there's also something that I think is about taking what is missing for me from theatrical space into this hybrid model, which is, what is the before and after? Which is also a thing that has nothing to do with Netflix. It's, what is the virtual comparison to, I go into the bar, I buy an overpriced wine, it is very good, I say hello to Nick, and I sit down. Because I think the other thing I've noticed a lot of online work is, there's so much attention to the piece, and there's very little attention in what the space is before and after, and how we communicate during. And that's, I think, probably one of the things that we're missing as much, if not more, than the shows we would be seeing in this time. And I'm personally really interested in direct audience development and figuring out that before and after.
That's great, Paula. Thanks. I'm going to actually bounce it back to Tom, because I think with the DARE Festival, you did something that I haven't seen anyone else do yet, which is using this platform called Gather, where you get this little avatar when you enter the digital space, and you have to walk your avatar to the theater and literally run into your friends on the way. It was a completely different kind of experience. So, Tom, do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, totally. Can I just come back on some of what Paula was saying first? I hate to have brought Netflix into the room, because actually I think we agree on pretty much everything. But I do think, like, it is important to note that something that Eve Lee pointed out on a blog recently is that when we operate in spaces that people can use at home, we're part of the attention economy in a way that we're not. I mean, the attention economy is the economy, but like, it's very different when we go to a live theater space versus the kinds of experience for audiences when you're in your place of residence, compared to, you know, when you visit a live space, are really different. And how we create and curate those experiences. I think Paul is spot on. I think, like, most of the time, there isn't a lot of attention given by artists to the before and after of a digital event. And to be fair, that's because, like, I mean, so many artists have had to learn so many things in the course of the last year. And then to suddenly go, oh my God, like, now we have to think of this whole other layer. But when you're creating a piece of a digital performance, you've got two big challenges. And the first one is that probably people are logging in 30 seconds before it's due to start and expecting everything to be ready. And the other is that, you know, people are all over the place, and, like, you know, some people are really familiar with the medium and some people aren't. Some of us are super engaged in, I mean, everyone on this call, we wouldn't be here if we weren't already super engaged in the arts, obviously. But so even within that, like, you know, Paula has clearly engaged with a lot more digital stuff online than I have. But with, it means that your audience have a really different level of experience, whereas, and that's true when you go to the live theatre, when you go to the theatre live, whatever live means in the 21st century as well. But, how do you create a space in which audiences simultaneously feel safe and comfortable, but at the same time also are able to have some of the same sense of interaction and participation that you would, you know, if you walked into the foyer at home. So what we did at DARE Festival, because we couldn't be in Shoreditch Town Hall, we made an avatar of Shoreditch Town Hall online. So we used this platform called Gather, which is it's designed for conferencing. It's designed for remote conferencing. It's used by a lot of people in the tech sector. And it basically creates a map of a virtual space that you can explore, and everybody who appears gets an avatar that they can move around using the arrow keys on the keyboard. So it's like it looks a bit like sort of a 90s Legend of Zelda type thing. So I'm well into it. I was sold on it, like, straight away when we saw it. The nice thing about it is it lets you, so when for DARE, we basically created like a foyer space and you appear in that. There are virtual ushers who are real people who are actually in Shoreditch Town Hall talking to you about where to go in virtual Shoreditch Town Hall, which is joyously confusing. And then you move around that space. There are various like interactive Easter eggs that we put within that space for people to explore, but there is a main space that you go to, and when you get there, normally it opens a Zoom link that takes you to another performance. And the feedback that we got on that was really from audiences. Artists loved it. Artists absolutely loved it because we're all trying to figure out how to do this stuff. Audiences really depended, and it's sort of loosely correlated with how much digital theatre that they'd seen. So people who had engaged with quite a bit of digital work really enjoyed seeing something that wasn't on Zoom, because of course, you know, Zoom became so pervasive so early in the pandemic. And they really enjoyed the opportunity to meet with one another. And we got that from some non-theatre professional audiences as well, like, that they really enjoyed it. But I think for people who were working artists who maybe knew someone who was making one of those pieces of work, you know that feeling when you watch something on Zoom and then you get to the end and then you turn off and then you have to like WhatsApp your mate or whatever to go, oh, hey, I thought that was great. Or if it's not someone who you know, but you like have a connection with, or you've seen their work and they admire them. And if you're at CPT or something, you might just walk up and go, hey, I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed that show. And you can't do that if you just hit the leave button in the bottom right of your screen. So it's really nice for those audiences to be able to kind of wander around this gather space and like bump into someone in the corridor. That was really cool. The flip side of that was we had, in particular, there was one show in the program this year that was aimed at families. And in general, what the people who had booked tickets for their kids to come and see the show needed from us was easy access. They needed to be able to click start at a particular time. They needed the show to start. They needed their kids to be able to watch it. And they needed to basically click a button and go away, in the same way that, you know, when my niece sits in front of Hey Dougie, my niece is sitting in front of Hey Dougie and my sister can finally sit down for 5 minutes, you know? And I think that's I think that's one of the biggest challenges that we've got as we continue exploring hybrid models, is how much input are we asking from our audiences, and how much are they prepared to give us, which is why Javar's sort of double screening idea is so cool, because it means that people can be simultaneously and engage with us and on multi-devices, or they can be simultaneously engaged and not engaged at the same time, in the same way that we would with other forms of experience. I'm not going to mention Netflix again, but something that you have, like, I was really struck watching the new season of Line of Duty the other night, which is watch along, right? Like, that's a watch along is not something that theatre has come up with. None of the things actually that Amy listed at the beginning are things that have emerged from the theatre sector. They're all things that we have borrowed and adapted from elsewhere, I think. And so, yeah, like, what are the ways that we can be nicking those ideas from other sectors in a way that work, but also when we're inviting audiences into our digital spaces, how do we make it as easy for them as possible to engage without sort of putting in extra layers of barriers to participation?
Great, thanks, Tom. We'll switch our BSL interpreters. So we'll pause for a moment. Great, thanks, Rachel. I can't believe how the time has flown. This has been really great, and we're going to open up to questions in a minute. So if you have any questions you'd like to ask the panel, can you pop them in the chat or make yourself known to Nick so that we can see you or hear you on screen? But before we do that, I just want to go back to Kevin, because I think what Tom was mentioning connects to what Kevin was saying about digital poverty and like the audience experience. How can we, what can we do? What are you thinking about at home in terms of making sure audiences and artists can access these kinds of shows?
It's still an ongoing conversation, I guess, that we're having, but I think that's what I was saying about from our perspective, where, you know, it's weird how our shorthand became digital is not live. So like, but also digital didn't mean online either, like all the time. I think, you know, it's about us looking at what else is. We did a project where postcards were sent out in the post to people. We had things where you could pick it up from the venue. So it was also looking around that sort of element as well. So it's not just always about, like, it's Zoom, it's YouTube, it's this kind of stuff that is always, you know, online, I suppose, without using the D word of digital. So, and also how is things adaptable as well? So if it, you know, is there an offline version? Is there a way you can do that as well as, doing it online as well? So it's just something that now sits, I guess, within everything we do. And I think that sits, like, and sort of building off what Tom was just saying as well, I guess, around access, which I think is, again, speaking as a venue and to, you know, almost kind of throwing this out other venues, you know, I think the access of what's happened over this year, I think, has been phenomenal in terms of start times, adaptable, actually how accessible everything has been, you know, on the whole. I'm sure there are also ones that aren't, but, you know, from what I've seen that has been there, way, way more than anything was pre-pandemic. And actually, how does that remain as a core thing? And the venues can't then just go back to how it used to be, you know, in that sense. So I think that also, that accessibility of everything has been a real boon, I think, over the last year with the digital stuff.
Great, thank you. And Jamal was talking about, you know, you don't have to be, you don't have to be super techie to make this stuff work. Jamal, what would you say to people who are just getting started in digital theatre and who might yes, not know where to begin?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think I would say a couple of things. One is I would say that I welcome Kevin drawing attention to how annoying the word digital is. So, like, in terms of that question about getting started with digital theatre, like, one thing I would say is that, like, what's apparent is that there's nothing to worry about because it's just the same as making a show. Like, just do it. Do you know what I mean? It's literally just the same. In the same way that you don't know what a play, I mean, certainly the way I write a play is like, oh, these are interesting things. I wonder if there's a way to make up, do you know what I mean? Same sort of vibe. I sometimes joke that I think, like, I used to work at I've worked in theatres as well. I was associate director at the Crucible for a year and a half as part of the Arts Council Changemakers programme for BME people, blah, blah, blah. And I used to tease other senior management colleagues at the Crucible that hearing senior management people in British theatre talk about digital struck me as largely what I imagined it would be like to hear BBC executives in the 1950s talk about rock and roll. Do you know what I mean? This kind of just box of, like, fear, but that you're going to have to open at some point because the kids like it. So I don't think there is, like, a straight up starting point. It's just about going. It's like any other two. I happen to be an artist who's really, really interested in form. Do you know what I mean? So if you've got an interest in it, I think that it's just a play, isn't it? Like everything else. I think one little thing I would just say on the end of what Kevin was saying, if that was all right, about this question of digital poverty and so on, is one of the things that I distrust is sometimes on the liberal left side of things, which I imagine most of us are on this call, sometimes I think the question of access and diversity loses its punch when we talk about accessibility and equity as a sort of generally vague thing, and then imagine how to try and get what we're doing to everyone in the world. I think these questions are actually much more transformative for organisations and for individuals when you're dealing with going, like, you know, for instance, this is where our building is. Just over there is, like, a community of Afghan refugees, do you know what I mean, who've never engaged with what we've done, some of whom have got, like, this issue, some of whom have got that issue, some of whom are broke, some of whom ain't. So that thing about, I think it's really important that digital poverty, as much as anything else, to think really specifically about how race, how social class, how poverty, whatever, is stopping people hanging out with you in that way that you would like to hang out with them. Do you know what I mean? As opposed to a general, because now sometimes when we do the general thing, we sometimes get into that competitive liberalism. Do you know what I mean? Which I don't think is necessarily helpful.
Well put. Thanks, Javad. I'm going to go to some questions that we've got in the chat. And Nick, I think we've got three people who want to verbally ask a question. Is that right?
No, the three written questions. So Paula has responded to Esther's question around networks, the digital performance network in the chat. I'll ask these three questions for you in the panel. The first one was Lou. I'd love to hear about funding for projects, specifically funding outside of the Arts Council. There's a question from Suzette around the digital lens, a worry that the digital landscape can make theatre less accessible in terms of access to audiences for new artists, as opposed to an artist and their piece in a room above a pub being hosted by a theatre. And a third one specifically to Tom from Alice, which was, could, and if so did, audience members get lost in the virtual shortage town hall and thus turn up late for their performance?
Shall I come back on that one quickly?
Sure, go for it, Tom.
They could theoretically got lost. I don't think anyone got lost. We did have a few people who couldn't figure out, despite the built-in, like, the built-in tutorial functions and all that, couldn't figure out how to navigate their avatar around the space. So they weren't lost, but they were unable to enter the performance space because they were moving around like a confused person in a space. So what we did with those guys was we normally hold the show, let them in late. We put in some contingencies to help us sort of navigate them in, send people direct Zoom links, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's kind of the same thing as the barrier to participation that comes from experiencing a piece of new technology. If you have to try and learn, if any of us had to try and learn something in 30 seconds, it's difficult. So yeah.
Great. Thanks, Tom. I'm seeing there's another question as well about pricing that might go hand in hand with the funding question.
Funding question. There's one on pricing, which is interesting thoughts on pricing. As the years go on, tickets are becoming more expensive, and is there a danger it'll become like physical spaces? And there's still the question about whether digital theatre and access.
Thanks.
I have zero thoughts on funding. I would love someone else to tell me about that in this realm, to be honest. But I can say a little bit on pricing, just virtue of experimenting with running events completely off my own back without a venue through this. One of the things that I learned that was really surprising to me is having price scales. Like I think I just assumed if you had an event and you said, okay, there's like low income is whatever it is, no income is this. And I think me and my club were saying abundant at like the top tier. 12 or 15 price. I just assumed everyone would go, okay, well, then we're not paying for it, or we're going to pay the lowest possible. And actually what I found in the last couple events I did is there was a pretty even split between people who wanted to pay the top tier ticket price and people who could afford to pay the low tier ticket price. And I found the same thing with workshops. Lately, when people are asking me for rates more often, I'm going, here's my scale from unfunded to NPO. Pitch yourself within that. And I think that's something I found in this period. And also the question around audience development, I could say a little bit about. I mean, again, one of the things that I found really interesting in this time has been building a more direct relationship with my audience. Like I've always had a big presence on social media and used social media as a way of sharing my work. But I, at the beginning of the year, I did have quite a lot booked in terms of touring. And so I restarted my newsletter thinking I was going to be selling all of this work that I was producing in live spaces, which obviously got canceled this time last year. But I decided I was still going to develop this newsletter, and I went from having about 40 subscribers back in March to having about 400 to 450 just over the last few months. And the other thing that I found that's really interesting about that is then when I've sold tickets for things, or I've increasingly been just selling things through that newsletter, people buy them, and there's a really high take-up of that. That's something I would not have learned before this period, because I was always reliant, maybe too reliant on the venue. So that's another thing I suppose I could share.
That's great. Thanks, Paula. That kind of connects with what Suzette was asking about, you know, making the digital landscape, making theatre less accessible as in terms of access to audiences for new artists. You know, if you're an emerging artist, you can get a room above a pub and be hosted by a theatre, and the theatre will help you get an audience in sometimes. I would say that actually there's a lot of scope for artists to completely bypass gatekeepers with digital work. And this is what people were saying back when YouTube first became a thing, that, you know, anybody now can be a content creator And you can just put your stuff out into the world. It does mean that artists have to become their own marketing officers to get the word out and to find their audience. Tom, do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, we were doing that anyway. We were all doing that anyway. And just to come back to what Suzette was saying specifically about the Rumour Buffer Pub, with huge respect to all of the brilliant artists who run those rooms and all the brilliant artists who performed in those rooms, the Rumour Buffer Pub, someone is making money off of your work. It's not normally the people who run the venue above the pub. It's normally the brewery or the landlord, like not even the landlord of the pub, the landlord of the building that the pub is bought on. There's so much overhead in Rooms Above Pubs. I mean, so Upstart started doing shows in Rooms Above Pubs, and we don't do them anymore because they drain cash, time, energy. And by and large, you know, unless you're at somewhere really good, the venue doesn't have the capacity because they don't have the staff to be seriously leveraging your work in terms of marketing. Some do, and there are some really great ones out there. But actually, the great thing about the digital realm that we've been working in much more is exactly what Paula just said. You know, you have a completely different relationship with your artists. If you're selling things directly to them, you're building your mailing list much more quickly. We have experiences with venues where, you know, post performance, we've asked if it's, you know, or even, you know, pre-show. Venues now, like, there's a GDPR problem about sharing booker information, which you don't have if, again, you're selling tickets directly to people via Eventbrite, and you can gather data. So actually, I think you can do quite a lot more. And like our mailing list engagements, our social media stats over the last year have really demonstrated that to me. And yeah, we were all doing our own show marketing anyway, most of us, I think, in the sector.
Great, thanks, Tom. Danny's pointing out in the chat, the room above a pub is usually inaccessible to wheelchair users. Which is a big issue with Fringe Theatre, yeah. Right, there's one more question and we've got 1 minute. Does anyone have any thoughts on this question about making art pieces as an interactive film like Bandersnatch from Black Mirror on Netflix and the audience interaction on this?
I could throw in on this. Please. I mean, like, Rich Kids is basically like, if you squint, it's an interactive film. So, yeah, I mean, look, I'd say there's two things. One is like, same as if it was in a theatre, which is if you've got audience interaction, you just need to make the space for it right. Do you know what I mean? So it's about a relationship between what's happening being broadcast, like it would be in the space, and making sure there's space in, like, directorially and whatever else for that moment of interaction to, like, breathe and do its thing. And all that stuff is stuff that you'd work out just in the same way you would if it was a kind of like, you know, an in-person event. For us, like, the learning curve of, like, doing that stuff digitally was largely about working out how we were going to make all the stuff happen and look like a bit of magic as you want. Do you know what I mean? So that's like, for me, if I had a practical thing to say, I would just go, you know, make sure in your, when you're directing, make sure on your rehearsal schedule or whatever, you're willing to lose a day to play with Instagram live feed lags. Do you know what I mean? Like, just shit like that, basically. Do you know what I mean? We basically ended up making Rich Kids largely through a bit of software called Open Broadcasting Software, OBS, which is like absolutely free. It's like freeware stuff, and it's how Twitch streamers and stuff work. And yeah, man, we needed to have a bit of time so that the production management people could play around with that. Do you know what I mean? So it's just about being a little bit baggy, I think, in terms of, just in the same way. Again, I go back to this like silly metaphor of like, it's like super old school devising theatre stuff. Do you know what I mean? In the same way that if we were being really 80s and we had like an 80s devising company, we're like, we're going to put ladders in this show. Do you know what I mean? People are going to be running up and down ladders. They'll be twiddling the ladders, blah, blah, blah. You'd have like a 2 days of ladders, wouldn't you? Do you know what I mean?
That's a really great way of thinking about it. Thank you. And thank you, everyone. I realize we've got to wrap up now, but thank you so much to Rachel and Lynn and Nick and Kevin, Tom, Paula and Javad. This has been a really interesting, lovely conversation. I'm just going to end by throwing a couple of links in the chat and doing a cheeky plug, really, for the Theatre Maker program at the Cockpit, where in May I'm running a devising online course, which is all about getting to grips with these digital tools. I've also created a Zoom Theater Starter Guide that I'm popping in the chat now. And I would really encourage everyone who's interested in this to join the Digital Performance Network that Paula mentioned earlier. The link to that is in the chat as well. And it's also in the Zoom Theater Starter Guide. Wonderful. Let's see what happens. I think there's a wide open field of possibility here and some really interesting questions. Some pretty inventive, determined artists and programmers working on exploring what this is going to turn into. So congratulations to everyone for being part of this, at the start of this new phase, I think, in theater making. Brilliant. With that, I will say thank you all and take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you all very much. I'll close the link now. Have a good day.
Super. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.